Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White. California is usually ahead of the curve when it comes to many things, from technology and the economy to healthcare and environmental issues. And the Golden State in particular is known for its ambitious climate policies, even though they may have taken a back seat because of the pandemic. We'll speak with CAP Radio's Ezra David Romero about how Governor Gavin Newsom is hoping to meet the goals that are being set by the Biden administration, including how California could work toward advancing environmental and racial justice. Later in the hour, we'll also get a sense of what to expect from the upcoming storm and winter weather advisory. But first, the majority of the state was under a regional stay-at-home order since early December due to low ICU capacity. Now, the California Department of Public Health has lifted that order, citing projections that show a significant spike in ICU capacity throughout the state. Joining us now to put the numbers in perspective for us is CAP Radio's health reporter, Sammy Cayola. Good morning, Sammy.
Good morning, Nicole. Thanks for having me.
So one of the first questions the governor answered yesterday was what metrics are being used to calculate projected ICU capacity, because that's what lifted us all out of the stay-at-home order. Many were questioning these decisions because that formula had not been made public. Dr. Mark Galli answered and said that the information would be put on the health department's website. Looking at this website, Sammy, the health department, it doesn't look like, has released that formula for how they came to their conclusion. What have the experts that you've been speaking with saying about that?
So I spent a lot of yesterday trying to track down the answer to that question, and these metrics still remain a mystery. The physicians and scientists I spoke to said they didn't know exactly what calculations the state is using at this point to project ICU capacity 3 weeks out. But there is some good news here. The general concept is simple, right? If infection rates are going down, which we are seeing them go down pretty steadily, we appear to be out of that really intense post-holiday spike we saw. With infections down, hospitalizations will be down, and ICU capacity will be freed. More beds will be available. So I spoke to emergency room physicians who felt like, okay, we used to have, you know, a faucet that was overflowing with patients, and now we have a trickle. So as long as these trends hold up for the next couple of weeks, they feel pretty secure that those ICU projections will be close to accurate. I know to the average listener or reader, it might look like, whoa, that's a huge change. Suddenly we're going to have all this ICU capacity. But it really does just equate to fewer cases equals fewer hospitals.
Okay. Well, in places like Los Angeles, ICU capacity is still very low at this moment. What are the concerns of healthcare officials in areas of the state where they're still experiencing that high surge of patients?
Sure. So they are too really crossing their fingers that they start to see a downward trend and that that trend holds downward. They're worried about their resources. Staffing has been a huge concern since the start of the pandemic. There is still a lack of people who are trained to work in intensive care, and there's still a shortage of nurses and other staff you can use to backfill when your employees become sick if they catch COVID-19. Now, hopefully the first round of vaccinations to health workers is going to help with that. We also saw the state send out an influx of backfill workers, and we've also seen them open up alternative care facilities like field hospitals. So those are all good fallbacks, but these facilities, as you said, are still slammed, and they are really banking on these rates going down and not up in the next 3 weeks. And that really depends on people's behavior. The big question is, are we going to see a huge spike now that counties don't have to follow these stay-at-home orders? And you know, all the scientists I spoke to said it really depends on what precautions are taken. Inherently, being outdoors at, you know, say a dining establishment on the patio doesn't have to be a place for transmission. If it's done correctly, if people wear masks and they stay with their own families, you know, we haven't seen that much spread in those settings. So, you know, it's going to be a matter of, are people going to throw huge parties because they think everything is okay now? And it's not. We are not out of the woods.
Okay. Well, I mean, talk about how to balance those two things. When people hear that restrictions are being lifted, they might think, oh, you know, I can go do this and this and this now. What are scientists worried about here, that the scientists you've been speaking with?
Yeah, they are worried that we're going to see something similar to what we saw around the holidays, which is a lot of people gathering indoors, not wearing masks, not staying apart. They're hopeful that with the weather getting better in parts of the state where we have a winter, people will return to socializing outdoors. You know, there is the Super Bowl coming up. We don't want people packed into houses, sharing snacks, taking their masks off to eat and drink and yell at the television. So we don't want people to think that everything is okay now. Everything is looking a little bit better, but it's not going to stay that way if we don't take the precautions we need to take. So the idea is, you know, if businesses can be really vigilant about keeping people outdoors, about limiting group sizes, about making sure that both servers and patrons wear masks when they aren't eating, that we do have a chance at staying leveled out.
Well, there's also these new strains, these new variants that are appearing in parts of California. Have the scientists you've been speaking with said anything about how those could spread? We know they're more infectious with lifting restrictions.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. That could be a huge curveball. We don't exactly know how this is going to hit us yet because it's not yet the dominant strain here in California. But the new variants, like the one we saw in the UK, do appear to be more contagious. They are spreading faster. And if that becomes the main strain that we have in our community, we are going to see infection rates go up, especially because the vaccination rollout has been as slow as it has been. This is Erin Mordecai. She's the biologist at Stanford University.
And the more we allow transmission to occur, the more quickly that's going to happen. And the more quickly we're going to see another surge because of the new variant. You know, I think we're in a small window where the holiday period is sort of fading away, the impacts of that holiday period, and we're not yet seeing the impacts of these new variants.
And so, you know, she said we're in a window, right? Like things look okay now, we're feeling okay, but it's going to be really easy for us to go straight back up considering these new variants. And just to remind people, you know, just because things are allowed, you know, church services are allowed now, outdoor dining is allowed, you shouldn't be going anywhere inside really with anybody that is not your immediate family. And even if you're going to go outside, we really want you to keep your people that you see consistent. We want you to keep your bubble pretty small.
Okay, so what
if we still need to protect the healthcare system? It's going to be very easy for it to become overwhelmed again.
Exactly. Well, there is a balance here. I heard a story you had on this morning about doing those small gatherings and, you know, getting more social people. And we've all been missing that this last year. It does become a mental health issue. Talk about how we could do maybe small gatherings safely.
One of the experts I talked to yesterday said she was actually really happy that gatherings could come back. So these were, you know, we saw in October that Governor Newsom put out gathering guidelines. This was right before Halloween. And, you know, they basically defined what health officials think you can do relatively safely. So they say don't get together with more than three households, so your own household plus two other households. Keep it to 15 or fewer people and make sure it's outside. And if you're going to be in close proximity because you're going to be, you know, talking to one another or eating food together, keep your mask on. Obviously, if you need to eat or drink and need to take your mask off, back up. You know, just spread everybody out. Being outside and being distanced, that's two layers of protection. Wearing a mask when you're outside is even better. But, you know, there is a mental health component to this. It's difficult for us to not see anyone. It's arguably very unhealthy to not see anyone. This is Erin Mordecai from Stanford again.
Not that we should all have huge gatherings, but I think the ability to see people outdoors in a socially distanced setting with a mask on, with, you know, small numbers of people, I think we all need that for our mental health and our social health.
So hopefully we learned our lesson around the holidays and it won't happen that way again.
Sammy, we talked about this a bit yesterday after Governor Gavin Newsom's press conference. Bring us up to speed on what's happening with the vaccine. There was a lot of news and chatter last week that it was happening very slowly. It sounds like that may have just been a data reporting problem and that the state has given out about half of our doses. Where are things right now?
So I would still say it's going pretty slowly. You're right, there was a lag in the data. So for a while, we thought that only about a quarter of all the doses given to California had actually been administered to people. Now it looks like a little more than half of those shots have actually gone into people's arms. And, you know, which shots go into which arms at this point is up to both county health departments and up to the health providers that counties contract with. So, you know, Sac County is giving all of their medicine to UC Davis and Kaiser and Sutter, and even to some clinics and some pharmacies that can reach people outside of those systems. And so, you know, it's possible that these health entities are holding on to some of the doses for a second round, or that they're still really figuring out how to administer these shots. They're difficult to handle, they're difficult to store, they require extra monitoring, and it's a big lift, especially if you are not an entity that usually provides vaccines. So we're on the path. It's just going to be a very long path because there still is not a lot of supply. And we are hearing from the state now that they really want counties to prioritize people age 65 and up. And in California, I mean, we're a huge populous state. We've got a large elderly population. Just vaccinating those people is going to take us many weeks, possibly months, right? So we might even see counties shift away from phase 1B, which was going to be farm workers, teachers, law enforcement, in favor of making sure we get all of our elderly residents vaccinated. And the argument behind that is that older people are the most likely to end up in the hospital. And again, we are trying to reduce strain on our health system.
Okay.
And so more news on that probably coming today.
But again, the governor has said that counties, you know, the state has these guidelines of prioritizing which groups, but counties can basically prioritize who they want, correct?
They should be able to make their own decisions. They are supposed to consult with the state. But yeah, you are allowed to vaccinate multiple tiers at the same time. So you may see counties that are trying to do a mix of vaccinating both seniors and, say, farm workers, if that's a huge workforce in their county and they're really worried about that population. So, you know, we'll see counties sort of making their own plans, but they are supposed to follow the state guidelines. And the state has been pretty clear about vaccinating people 65 and up as quickly as we possibly can.
Sammy Cayola is Cap Radio's health reporter. Thanks so much for joining us today, Sammy. Up next, a look at how Governor Newsom has tackled climate change policy so far and how the Biden administration could push California to do better. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White. The environment has been a hot topic for years as the average global temperature continues to climb. Since 1981, the temperature has increased at a rate of about 3/10 of a degree Fahrenheit each year. California has been at the forefront of climate change policy. State lawmakers generally look towards science to guide them in helping to reduce the effects of global climate change. Earlier this month, Governor Gavin Newsom announced his budget proposal would allocate $1.5 billion toward funding electric or hydrogen vehicles and the infrastructure to support these types of cars on the road. There are many more environmental updates from the state to unpack, including wildfires, water issues, and the pushback the state received from the Trump administration. And for that, we turn to Cap Radio's environment reporter, Ezra David Romero. Thank you for spending some time with us today, Ezra.
Hey there.
So let's start with something Newsom always seems to focus on when it comes to environmental policy, which is the reduction of vehicle emissions. Back in September, he signed an executive order mandating that by 2035, all new vehicles sold in California must be zero emission. And in his budget proposal a few weeks ago, he said he wants to spend $1.5 billion on electric and hydrogen vehicle purchases and the infrastructure, things like charging stations. Why are emission reductions such a hot topic?
So, Nicole, they're a big deal for a couple of reasons. One, California has this goal of 5 million electric vehicles on roads by 2030. That's a Governor Brown policy. And so far, the state only has less than 800,000 on roads so far. So there's a huge ramping up needed. And all that's important because reducing pollution from transportation is about, well, pollution is about 50% of all pollution comes from cars and trucks in the state. And that's a lot, right? So those fumes, along with carbon and other greenhouse gases, are what are causing this climate crisis. So there's direct correlation with the cars we drive and the crisis we're in right now. And that's the same reason why we hear so much about reducing from other sectors. Newsom's work has been lauded around clean car policy, but to make a real impact, experts like Deborah Sieves say Newsom needs to focus even more on the source. And where's that source? The oil and gas industry. So Sieves is an attorney with the Stanford University of Environmental Law, and here's what she had to say.
The flip side of climate policy we've talked about is the oil and gas side, which I think is his real Achilles heel, because there have been several thousand new oil and gas permits issued during his tenure. So it feels a little bit schizophrenic to be, you know, promoting these really ambitious climate goals and yet still facilitating and supporting new fossil fuel infrastructure.
Yeah, Newsom has gotten a lot of pushback for still issuing, you know, fracking permits and things like that. But I want to stay on this car issue with you, Ezra. Does Newsom actually have the authority to phase out fossil fuels this way?
Well, Sieves, you know, she studies this. She says Newsom does have the authority. It's in his purview to do this, but he doesn't want to. And that's maybe perhaps because of the fear of lawsuits, the litigation and things like that will happen. He did ask the legislature in September with that executive order to phase out fracking, to come up with a plan by 2024. And that was part of that executive order.
Okay. Well, what goals has Newsom set that are different from his predecessor, Jerry Brown? And why does it seem like it's taking so long for these environmental policies to be put into place?
Yeah, it may seem like it's been quiet for the past 2 years on all this, but it really hasn't. Newsom has set some big goals, you know, everything from all new cars and trucks, you know, being zero emission by 2035, a similar goal for big rigs. You know, then there was this big water package that came out in July with these 142 actions with a goal to prevent climate change. And then he did another executive order in October that's to conserve 30% of state lands and waters by 2030. All of this is new, right? But it sort of builds on policies and goals that Brown set up, right? We have this goal of carbon neutrality by 2045, or these 5 million electric cars on roads by 2030. And so these are sort of notches and next steps to get there. You know, there's other reasons why environmental policies are taking so long. You know, one, it's complicated, right? Like there are a lot of interests and change often means loss for those interests. So there's pushback, right? Then we're also talking about a state with 40 million people, and each part of the state has its own issues in when it comes to the environment. There's deserts, there's cities, there's, you know, mountain areas, there's the Delta. And then there's the opposing interests. And then lastly, the Newsom administration's been fighting tooth and nail against the Trump administration for the past 2 years with, like, you've reported on it, more than 100 lawsuits, right? Mm-hmm. Around environmental things and other things, just holding the line against the Trump administration. So there's been a lot of active work, but it may appear to the public like it's been quiet.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I understand a lot of these executive orders are very long-term goals, and many of them have probably flown under the radar because people are focused on other things the past year. What do environmental advocates think that Newsom should be focusing on right now?
Well, Nicole, you're super familiar with this line that Newsom has made in almost every press conference, you know, like, let's meet the moment.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And that's sort of what, you know, that's sort of what environmental advocates are saying back to him now. You know, it's like, you're no longer under this cap of the Trump administration. You have a Biden administration that wants to work with you. So meet the moment, you know, like be bold, not just in word alone, but in action, and maybe leave some of that incrementalism behind that the Brown administration held on to. Like, make some policies that have immediate action versus having a policy that's going to be enacted in 15, 20 years.
Okay. Well, two other things that we definitely have to talk about in a bit here are wildfires and water. Last year, we saw this record-setting, devastating fire season. And with this pretty dry winter so far, we might expect a similar wildfire season again this year. Fingers crossed that doesn't happen. What is Newsom doing in order to help combat wildfires, Ezra?
Yeah, there's a few things, right? Three things. Cal Fire got around like something like $400 million more dollars this year to help around suppression efforts and prevention. He also did this sort of handshake partnership with the federal government to treat about 1 million acres every year by the year 2025. So that's still 4 years out. Then he also proposed about $1 billion for wildfire prevention to spend over the next year and a half, something like $323 million would have to be spent in the next couple of months. And that's a big deal because it's the first time ever that that's happened. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a lot of money, but it's also not a lot of money that wildfire experts talking about. Like, there's something like 15 different government agencies that are vying for that money. And so they say there needs to be focus on a few large projects to have the most impact, or use that money to create some kind of wildfire prevention program that could have long lasting effects versus going to like little projects here and there that'll cost millions and millions to do.
It seems like there's a theme here of, you know, bigger, bolder action instead of smaller, more incremental things. And of course, we have the new Biden administration coming in. Is there any help the state could get from the federal government to help some of these things?
Yeah, especially around wildfire, I think there's this idea that the Trump administration wasn't taking ownership of, you know, that a lot of these wildfires were happening on federal land, and about 50% of all forests in California are managed by the federal government. And there's not this robust wildfire prevention tactics on this forested land. And so I think there's just this hope that the Biden administration could partner with California and create this sense of camaraderie in, let's say, the Forest Service or Bureau of Land Management and the state to get this kind of work done, to change the mentality that around wildfire prevention and prescribed burns and make this a commonplace activity. And so I think that's the hope that, you know, Biden has this $2 trillion plan, and they hope that this will include a bunch of stuff around wildfire prevention.
I just quick personal note here. I mean, the fires burn in California and they're devastating, but they really have an effect across the entire West. I came from Utah, and anytime there's a huge wildfire here in California, a day or two later, there's the smog, the smoke that you can smell and just hangs over the air in other cities around the West. So I think having some help and a direction from the federal government is something any Western state would probably welcome. Ezra, water is always a big deal here in California. What has Governor Newsom done around water during his first 2 years in office?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is that last summer, Newsom issued this water resilience portfolio that outlines 142 state actions to help the state deal with water as the climate crisis worsens. You know, it works with this like Clean and Affordable Drinking Water Act. It deals with, protecting drinking water, groundwater, fish in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. You know, it's sort of this roadmap, but it also embraces this idea of a tunnel construction. You know, this is that project, that Twin Tunnels project that we've all heard about that would carry water from Northern California to southern parts of the state or the Central Valley. And, you know, this idea is often favored by farmers, but creating this $17 billion one tunnel project doesn't sit well with all environmental groups like Sierra Club California. You know, this group has asked the administration to come up with alternatives over and over again. Catherine Phillips is the group's director. And here's what she had to say about the project last summer when I talked to her.
All along the way, he's shown, and his administration has shown, a level of naivete about water policy in the state that's sort of jaw-dropping. They continue to believe that this project that was first proposed in the 1940s, I mean, we're going on 80 years now, will still satisfy California's water need even as we face a critical climate crisis that's changing the way water flows and when it flows and how it flows.
Ezra, you also reported on President Joe Biden's climate orders and how they could affect California. What is different with the Biden administration that wasn't there with the Trump administration?
I think the best answer to that is everything. You know, I think I wrote in my notes, I wrote E.V, you know, dot, everything. You know, I talked to about 10 experts for this story, and all of them are sort of taking this collective sigh of deep breath. You know, like, we can actually work on policy that we don't have to fight the federal government on. We have a federal government that has put equity and climate change at the center of its mission moving forward. And that's something that California hasn't done that well on, you know, and so it may push California to do better, to be better on environmental justice, to care about the poorest people in the state, to care about the people who live under freeways, to care about the people who live next to these big distribution centers across the state or near oil and gas fields. You know, I think there's this hope that the Biden administration can challenge California to do continuously better and, to maybe up our ante a little bit here.
Well, Ezra, we're going to have you stick around, and we're going to bring in the Director of Environmental Equity at the Green Lining Institute, Alvaro Sanchez. Alvaro, welcome to Insight. The Biden administration has made environmental and racial justice central to their plans. How are you seeing that California is prioritizing both of these in this upcoming legislative session?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the California legislature and the California government is prioritizing, but it needs to do a lot more. I think Ezra said it right. We haven't quite done nearly enough. And with the Biden administration coming in with such strong plans, actually, California must continue to lead and push the envelope. We have to continue to be the vanguard on climate issues, but also on how do we address racial equity. So what we do to do that is really think about everything that we're doing in the state as it having a relationship with our goals towards sustainability and racial justice. We can't just single out or silo out this issue into an environmental issue because it affects everything else that we do. Our goods movement, our food, our water consumption, where we live, what we build, everything is related. So we really should be continuing to push the envelope much further. And one of the best ways that we can do that is by, again, being the vanguard and having California be one of the leading states that just signals that we're going to end our dependence on fossil fuels. Making that strong statement, I think, would go a long way, not only in California, but nationally.
Well, just this year, the governor's proposed $1.5 billion to invest in vehicle electrification. How would this proposal address environmental justice?
Well, it does to a certain extent, but again, it needs to do so much more. $1.5 billion is a good amount of investment, and we need to increase our focus on the people and the communities that have the hardest time and the biggest barriers adopting this technology. In that $1.5 billion investment, there's $150 million that goes towards advancing clean mobility programs. And that's actually a really good investment, but it needs to be so much greater. In the bigger investment, the $1 billion that's going to charging infrastructure actually doesn't have a lot of equity design built into it. So that equity design needs to be there to make sure that the people that need this charging infrastructure the most and have the hardest time getting access to it are actually seen in this policy.
Alvaro, California has focused on equity and environmental justice in the past, although some would say that's mostly been in theory, not in practice. Why is it important that the Biden administration has equity as a tenet of his platform? Would this push California to care about all of its residents?
Well, even though California hasn't done the best, we've done a lot more than a lot of other states. So the fact that California has shown some progress, I think, allowed the Biden administration to be ambitious and bold on what they're trying to do. So we know what we can do when California focuses on an issue like environmental justice and equity. It led to a nationwide approach to addressing this issue. So now, as Ezra said, with the Biden administration being ambitious on these issues, California has no option but to be bolder in what we're trying to do to address environmental justice and pollution. These issues are so critical to addressing the persistent inequities that exist in our state, and we have to address them. If we don't, we're not going to reach our climate targets, or we're going to leave a lot of people out of our progress on climate issues.
I'm hearing the need for big and bold action. What are some specific things that you think would make the most immediate difference?
Well, first and foremost, we need a lot of resources to fight this fight. And one of the things that the state of California can do, and there's actually several proposals to do this, is to bond money to be able to build our resilience to these increasing impacts of climate change. But in those bond proposals that are being discussed, we see a severe lack of an emphasis on vulnerable populations. We see resources towards natural resources and infrastructure, but we really need to see a lot more equity focus and a lot more focus on vulnerable populations to wildfires, to sea level rise, to drought, to extreme heat. All of these issues are going to be felt by people, and we don't see quite enough attention being placed on them. And then another thing that we can really do to be ambitious is to really quickly stop the extending the life of fossil fuels. This means signaling a time for phasing it out. This means increasing buffer zones so that people don't have to live near polluting facilities. And this also means being able to use our land use powers to be able to ensure that people are not having to live near polluting facilities.
Do you think that 2035 is an achievable goal, or would you like to see that that vehicle phase out even sooner?
I think it has to be even sooner. Whether that's achievable, I think, really depends on whether or not we have the political will to really, transition us to a faster timeline. I think the technology, which often is raised as one of the issues why we can't achieve these goals faster, is going to be, they're looking for signals. And if our signals are that we have to get faster in when we achieve those goals, I think we can actually push the technology to be adopted even sooner.
Can you talk about some maybe real life examples of where California has either succeeded or failed in terms of environmental justice and how that has impacted real life communities?
Absolutely. I think a huge success that's not well known is a program called the Transformative Climate Communities Program. This is a program out of the Strategic Growth Council that funds catalytic programs for sustainability in the most impacted communities in California. The communities that are funded by this program got to decide on their own what kinds of strategies they wanted to invest in. And these include housing, electric vehicle, car sharing programs, urban forestry, urban greening, renewable energy, all with an emphasis on equity. We have 7 communities in California that include Sacramento, Stockton, Oakland, Los Angeles, Ontario, Pacoima, that have all benefited from this program and received anywhere between $11 million to $70 million for that investment. And I think it's actually a model for the federal government to replicate across the nation. And I think that this program should be really looked at as one of the ones that, really signal what California can do. It's a California version of the Green New Deal. Hmm. And unfortunately, the program has not received an allocation of funding in this fiscal year by the governor's office, which makes me wonder why a program that does so well on equity doesn't actually get included in our fight towards addressing climate change.
Well, our environment reporter Ezra Romero is still here. He actually wrote a story about that program in Stockton. So maybe Ezra can tell us a little bit more about what you learned and how it's working there.
Yeah, Alvaro and I actually talked about that story like a year ago when I was looking for a story around climate change in the state and how it's impacting low-income communities. And yeah, so I think what stuck out to me from that story is that the city of Stockton, with help through the state grant, the state organization, sort of enabled regular people in the community to care about climate change, they listen to the people versus having this like top-down approach that says this is how it's going to be. They consulted the community, stakeholders in that community, people who are working in in a large mix of issues, whether it's criminal justice or, you know, heat islands or anything like that, or food resources. And they started seeing it all through the lens of climate change. And so they consulted the community. And as a result, the five or six things they're going to do, build trees, have a walkable neighborhoods, you know, have food in edible gardens and classrooms. They wanted to have the tangible benefits of climate change reach the city's impoverished and people who live in these communities that have been divested in for so long. And so the end goal of this whole project is to, you know, as the climate crisis worsens, you know, to have the whole city move forward and to be doing well. So not just certain pockets of the city are doing well as the world warms.
Alvaro, I want to ask you just a couple more questions. As far as the value on environmental justice at the state capitol here in Sacramento, how would you rate that?
I mean, I would rate it as increasing. It's clear that I started my role at Greenlining 6 years ago. And at that time, the conversation was about whether or not it mattered, this environmental justice question. That question is no longer there. People know it matters. People know that they have to think about it and focus on it. But now what we need to do is we need to increase our sophistication about what this means. Most people think that environmental justice is just a commitment that you make. It's just you saying we care about these things. But it actually means functional structural changes to the way that we make decisions about everyday life. And I think that that's the kind of the bar has been set higher now. So we do not no longer just want to, you know, have a program that commits a certain portion of funding to a community. We need that actual design of the whole thing to reflect the values that we stand for in California when it comes to environmental justice. And we've upped the ante. Environmental justice means a practice, not just a commitment to doing something better.
Well, California has been, you know, severely impacted by wildfires, extreme heat, and all these other climate impacts. What does the state need to do to better build the climate resilience of our state?
Again, we need to focus a lot more on the most vulnerable populations. These are folks that have a hard time when evacuations come. They don't have the technology to get notices that they need to actually leave their communities. And they have the hardest time being able to recover from a natural disaster. So we really need to design and figure out programming that allows those populations to be seen in the way that we're building resilience for our communities. We have to spend money to do this work. Again, there's resilience proposals for bond measures that are going anywhere between $6 billion and $10 billion. That's a start, but we need a lot more. And that money has to be programmed to address the issues of the most vulnerable populations, because those are the ones that are going to be most at risk to any climate disaster that we see in the future.
Alvaro Sanchez, Director of Environmental Equity at the Greenlining Institute. We also heard from Cap Radio's environment reporter, Ezra David Romero. Thank you both so much for taking the time to share your expertise with us this morning.
No problem.
Thank you.
Still ahead, much of Northern California is bracing for a winter storm this week. We'll take a look at how this could affect weekend travel and what you should do to prepare. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White. If you've been outside this morning, you may have noticed that it's much colder than it has been in recent weeks. A storm is approaching the area, and we are expecting rain to hit much of Northern California over the next week. Winter weather, high winds, and flash flood warnings are being sent out as we prepare for this bout of rain to hit. Joining us now to help explain this winter storm is meteorologist in charge at the National Weather Service in Sacramento, Michelle Mead. Good morning, Michelle. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Nicole. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the forecast, can you set the table for us, Michelle, and talk about a little bit where we are rain and snow wise for this winter so far?
So this winter so far has been pretty dismal. We are less than 50% of average for our precipitation in the valley and only about 55% of average for snowfall in the mountains. So not off to a good start at all. So the systems we've had come through have been, you know, kind of glancing blows, and we haven't seen a whole lot of impact from them. So this is definitely one that folks need to sit up and pay attention to, because this is going to bring lots of impacts.
Well, how many storms like this one that we're bracing for would it take for us to get back to, you know, what's considered normal?
So that's a very good question. So California typically averages between 5 and 7 of these atmospheric rivers or big storms a year. And when we see those 5 to 7, that's when we're having an average winter. This is our first one this winter. So if you do the math, we'd need another 5 to 6 more to get average. That being said, this system is on the stronger side for a couple of reasons. It's going to sit over us for the next several days. And the first impact is tonight with a pretty strong cold front that is bringing some heavy bands of precipitation. So not only are we worried about the mountain travel with, like you mentioned, the very cold air we've got in place this morning, those snow levels are quite low. And we've got many, many recent burn scars, especially in the Bay Area and along the San Joaquin Valley as well. So those are the areas that are likely going to see rain. All of our other burn scars are in that colder air mass, so they're going to see snow. And that's also an impact. But for flash flooding, it's really the rain we're worried about.
Okay. I was going to ask, is there a difference between how rain and snow affect these burn scar areas that are, you know, are always dangerous when we're seeing storms of this level?
Yes, there is a difference. Snow obviously will coat the ground, and it will not seep into the small cracks and fissures that are left behind in the burn scar, so you don't have to worry about debris flows from that. Rain, on the other hand, we've already had a couple of rain showers or rainstorms that haven't really done much of an impact. What makes this one different is it's a quick hitting storm with a lot of rain in a short amount of time. So as the front comes through, and here's the big part, the front is not coming through until after midnight tonight. So folks will be sleeping in their beds, and all of a sudden they're going to hear the winds really picking up and the rain as the front is approaching. It's that time frame right ahead of and as the front is going through that we're most worried about. So for the northern Bay areas from the LNU, the Glass, the Hennessy, CZU, and SCU, those are the areas we're watching tonight. So if you haven't been in contact with your emergency manager in any of those burn-related areas, please reach out and find out what the latest communication is. Because like I said, if you're in harm's way, now's the time to take action, because this is going to be coming overnight. And the warnings aren't issued until we really see that intense rainfall hitting it. They're under watches right now, and that's really different from any of our other weather watches. Normally we say, okay, now's the time to prepare, but don't take any action. You wait till the warning. The debris flow, we really want you to start taking some action, preventative action, when the watch is issued, because when the warnings come, you don't have much time to evacuate. You need to evacuate ahead of the storm. So definitely be listening to your emergency managers. If you're not signed up for your county alerts, we strongly recommend you reach out to them so you get alerted when your emergency management community makes those calls.
Okay, definitely good to know urgent things for people in those areas that were impacted by wildfires last summer to keep in mind. What about people who are not in those areas but might still be seeing a lot of heavy rainfall or wind blowing over trees or fences or things like that, maybe power outages?
Exactly. So the winds that we're going to see tonight are going to be very strong. We're expecting sustained winds, and that's, you know, just blowing generally 35 to 40 miles an hour. So as the front is approaching, like I said, it's going to go from north to south. So starting from the coastal range around midnight, and by the time you get to the San Joaquin Valley around 5 a.m., we could see gusts well over 50 to 60 miles an hour when the front is passing through. That is definitely strong enough to blow down trees, power lines, and cause impact to your homes. Also, the rain, because we haven't seen a lot of rain and it's going to come in a relatively short amount of time, things like low water crossings or underpasses, those can quickly fill up. The good news is we're not going to have a lot of traffic. We're not going to have a lot of people out on the road in the middle of the night. So that is probably the one saving grace. But keep in mind, tomorrow morning, if you your alarm doesn't go off because we're out of power, you might want to take some extra time. Good thing, I think most folks are still teleworking, so it's a good time to hunker down if you can. And then always check the latest road conditions before you head out, especially in the mountains, because it's going to be downright nasty. Basically from Apple Hill all the way over the pass on 80, and from as far south as Red Bluff could see snow, all the way towards the Oregon border. So north and east is going to be very, very treacherous tonight.
Okay. Are we, do we have any avalanche warnings? Anything that bad?
There's an avalanche advisory out right now for the Tahoe Basin. So right around Lake Tahoe, you can go to the Reno Weather Service office and find out the latest information. But yeah, the wind is really the driving factor with this avalanche warning. So when you get winds blowing, and we're talking in the mountains now, 70 to 80 mile an hour gusts, what it does is it, you know, it hammers that snow against the hillside. And if there are any, so this is the exact opposite, right? Mm. So on the ground, the snow can't infiltrate the little fractures in the ground, so you don't have to worry about debris flows. On the mountains, that's a different story. When you have the wind driving that snow into those little fissures, it can drop that snow, and that's what can cause the avalanche. Mm. So yeah, it's just a crazy storm. Now is not the time to go check it out. I've heard some people say, hey, I want to go up in the mountains and see what this is all about. Do it this weekend when the storm is about over. Don't get up there tonight. Stay hunkered down, stay home, and stay prepared.
We will probably see some closures anyway on I-80 and Highway 50, right?
I'm not the travel expert, but given the amount of wind and snow, we are expecting at least 2 to 3 inch an hour snowfall rates. And the fact that it's so far down the hill, it will be, I know Caltrans has literally got all hands on deck. So they're going to do the best they can. But like I said, if you don't have to travel tonight, don't do it. Stay off the interstate basically from 8 o'clock onward. I would just stay home and stay hunkered down and let Caltrans do what they do best and clear those roads.
Well, if someone wanted to or needed to get over I-80 or Highway 50 in the next few days here, when are some windows of opportunity?
So this morning, you could leave now, and you'd probably be good if you left by 5 o'clock. That would give you enough time to get up and over. After that, we're going to see snow levels kind of fluctuating throughout the day. The heaviest precip will be tonight into tomorrow morning, and then we're going to have continuous snow showers all the way through Friday. So it'll probably be late Friday or maybe this weekend, but the heaviest is tonight, but it's going to be a snowy couple of days up there.
It's been a relatively dry winter so far. We've talked about that. Is this system one of those that might open the so-called storm door? We might be seeing more wet weather in the coming weeks and months?
So I'm an operational forecaster, which means I really kind of look at the next 7 to 10 days. And like I said, the rest of the week is definitely looking active. We are in a La Nina, and for those who don't know what that means, basically it's a ridge of high pressure that likes to set up along the West Coast, and California is made or broken by where that ridge sets up. So most of the winter, the ridge has been right over us, and that's resulted in our relatively warm and dry winter. This particular system has definitely made a shift in that area of high pressure out to the Pacific, and it has allowed some of these storms to come through, one of which is an atmospheric river, which is great. So the long range models are hinting that it could stay open for a while, but we never say never, because usually what happens is this is our wet time of year, and the long range models, they favor climatology. And what climatology is what do you typically see this time of year? January into February is one of our wetter parts of the winter. So after about 7 to 10 days, the models will always try to say, hey, you're going to stay active. And it doesn't always come out that way. So for the next 5 days, this is great news. We need the rain. We need the snow. We just got to get through the next 24 hours with this first batch of the front and the first punch of the atmospheric river. But it's definitely looking good for the rest of this week, which I guess will close out January. So keep tuned for February too.
Michelle Mead with the National Weather Service in Sacramento. Thank you so much for joining us today. And we'll have you on tomorrow morning with updates.
Sounds good. Talk to you then.
That is Insight for today. Learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. Our producers are Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minotta. Technical direction from Mark Jones and engineer Antonio Muniz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White. Thanks for joining us this morning.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.